Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, artists call on Boris Johnson to fix streaming. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt, and with me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when there was even more Great Escape stuff to plug.
There was indeed. The online edition of The Great Escape is getting very close indeed now. It's happening on the 13th and 14th of May. Although, if you get yourself a delegate pass, you will actually be able to log in to the online Great Escape platform at the start of Great Escape Week, because there'll be some on-demand content available for you when you get in there, including some brand new webinars from us here at CMU. You will also be able to connect with and network and arrange meetings with all the other people who are logging into the system at the same time. So yeah, it's all getting very close indeed, which is why in the CMU Daily at the moment, we're currently doing a panel of the day spot. It's in the middle of the Daily Bulletin. The little blue box. We always have a little blue box in the middle of the daily, don't we?
Always.
Are you missing the fact that you can't approve any music at the moment because I've stolen that box off you?
Yes, I am. I'm starting to think it was a bad idea to let you have that space as advertising space.
It's not advertising. It's keeping our readers up to date on the exciting and insightful and informative events that will be occurring online this year during Great Escape Week, which is much more important than whichever Nordic left of centre pop star you're plugging this week. So,
I try to avoid that now that you continually brought it up. I think it's worth pointing out, though, and stressing for people who might be thinking about buying tickets for The Great Escape, that as you said, it's not just a load of stuff on Zoom for you to watch passively. It is something where they've worked as hard as possible to get the physical conference experience into a digital form. So yeah, you can interact with other delegates, have meetings. You could have a drink, I guess, you know, virtually. That's something you could do. You can watch gigs. There's going to be live stream gigs in there. And you can watch all of our conference stuff, which is going to be great. I'll let you carry on now. I just thought I'd see if I could do some plugging after you said I wouldn't be able to do it last week.
Well done for doing some plugging.
See, I'm good at it.
Should stress, this platform is really good, but it doesn't mean that you can press a button and suddenly some beer will come out of your USB port on your laptop. That is one limitation that we haven't managed to make happen. But
I take back everything I just said.
It is a great platform. And also it means that if you can't tune in live to our sessions on the Thursday and the Friday of Great Escape Week, or not all of them because you've got meetings and other stuff going on, there's all the on-demand content that will be there when you arrive, plus all of the sessions that go out live will subsequently be available to watch on demand, and you'll still be able to access the platform after The Great Escape. In terms of some of the sessions that we at CMU will be presenting, in addition to the In Conversations that we've plugged on previous editions, amongst the panels we've already referenced in the daily, we've got a session as part of our Future Music Strategies strand on music rights data, because as regular listeners to the Setlist podcast will know, pretty much every problem in the music rights industry, so on the song and recording side of the industry, basically whenever things go wrong, it's because of shoddy copyright data. It is almost impossible to overstate just how big an impact bad copyright data has, particularly on songwriters. And so we're going to have a whole session where I've got such a good panel for that one. I'm pretty confident in an hour we can solve it. So you'll be able to watch us live solve the music industry's music rights data problem. The global repertoire database couldn't do it. It collapsed. A multitude of blockchain startups didn't manage it. We're going to fix it in an hour. That might be slightly ambitious, but we will definitely have lots of practical advice about how artists, songwriters, labels, publishers, managers can get rights data right. Other things that we've already announced, we have a session looking at a really interesting program that the Young Guns Network has been running in recent months in partnership with AWOL and with support from Youth Music, which basically is an initiative where they've taken five people really early in their music careers. They've given them some paid music marketing work supported by the team at AWOL, doing a marketing campaign on a real release, which is coming out very, very soon. And basically we'll have them reporting on that whole project and what they've learned along the way. So that should be interesting. We've also got a panel on influencing the influencers. Who the hell are the influencers in music today? And how do you reach them? And that could be influencers in the social media, YouTube influencer sense of the word, but we'll also be looking at where radio and press and journalists who occasionally write approved columns in music industry bulletins fit in. Are you an influencer, Andy?
Yeah, sure.
I think we need to ask our Influencing the Influencers panel as to whether or not they consider CMU's Andy Malt an influencer. So I'm going to add that.
I once won a competition because I was an influencer. But I think that was before people really knew what influencers were.
That was when having 17 Twitter followers made you an influencer.
Yes.
And then another panel, which I don't think we have actually announced as yet, but we will be in the next 24 hours as this podcast goes out, is we've got four brilliant managers who are all part of the MMF's Accelerator program, who are going to be talking about how you go about building a fan base for new talent in 2021. They all working with some very early career artists in lots of different genres, and they're going to be giving us lots of practical advice, which will be valuable to other managers and labels, etc., but particularly to the artists in a DIY phase, or educators and talent development organizations who are trying to help artists in the DIY phase. What information do you need to give them about the fan base building process? These are just some of the things we'll be talking about during the CMU strands at the Great Escape. Get your delegate pass now.
Right now.
And Andy Malt will help you with that by putting a link in the show notes.
I sure will.
But it's important to note that none of that, including the absence of the CMU Proved column in the Daily at the moment, none of that is what we are here to talk about this week.
No, this week, it's open letter week because we've got two of them to discuss. Later on, we will be discussing a letter to the European Union calling for it to beef up an element of its proposed Digital Services Act. But first, as the Culture Select Committee of the UK Parliament finishes writing its report on the big economics of streaming inquiry that we discussed before on the show, 156 musicians, including Paul McCartney, Damon Albarn, and Gary Barlow, the Dream Team, have put their name to a letter to the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, which contains three key demands. One, the extension of performer equitable remuneration to the making available right. Two, a competition investigation into the dominance of the major music companies. And three, a new regulator to ensure the lawful and fair treatment of music makers.
So yes, as you said, we have talked about this economics of streaming inquiry that's been going on in the UK Parliament on several editions of Setlist over the last few months. That inquiry kicked off late last year in response to a campaign organised by the Ivors Academy and the Musicians Union here in the UK, as well as the separate online campaign, the Broken Record campaign, led by Tom Gray from Gomez. And it was their campaigning that persuaded the Culture Select Committee in Parliament to do this big inquiry into the economics of streaming, which basically means over a series of oral sessions and via a whole load of submissions that were made from across the music industry and beyond, all of the debates which are contained in the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book that CMU and the Music Managers Forum published.
Link in show notes.
Based on all of the research we've done on this, all of the debates and conversations and topics and issues and controversies contained in that book have been discussed at length in these submissions and over these oral hearings, although not in quite as organised fashion. And that's not me bragging about how well our book organises all of these issues. I mean, it is me doing that. I'm actually doing that quite a lot. But it's a lot easier for one person to sit down and gather a whole load of research that we've done with the MMF, with input from managers and labels and lawyers and publishers, all of that, gather all of that together and then write it in one place. It's much easier when you're doing that for everything to be coherent and making sense. Whereas when you've got lots of different people all independently writing their submissions and then lots of people rocking up at Parliament or logging on to Parliament's Zoom account more likely, and then being asked questions from MPs, half of whom only half understand the issues, you're going to end up with quite a chaotic debate. And that is what we've had as part of the economics of streaming inquiry in Parliament. An important debate nonetheless, even though it has been a little bit chaotic and confusing at times. As we currently speak, the select committee are still working on their final report. So I suppose that's their opportunity to take all of these many, many, many different submissions and all the slightly confusing, chaotic oral hearings and to make it coherent. So we will see whether the final report is coherent. We will also see what it recommends, what it advises government and parliament to do about the various issues around the streaming business model. But yeah, this letter, which was organised by the MU, by the Average Academy, and by Tom Gray's Broken Record Campaign to Boris Johnson and the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Culture Secretary, I guess is preempting that report, possibly acknowledging that there are so many elements to this wider debate and it can be quite hard to get your head around them. What this letter was basically doing was summarising all of that with three key demands from the musician, artist, songwriter community, which, as you say, is an ER demand, a competition investigation demand, and this idea that maybe the music industry at large should be regulated in some way.
Although, as you say, there were lots of different strands to the debate, and in the end, it was a little bit chaotic. The main focus of the inquiry was the digital pie debate. So how the money handed over by Spotify, etc., to the music industry is shared out between all the different stakeholders. So that will be the record labels, the music publishers, featured artists, session musicians, and songwriters. And many argue that under the current model, labels get too big a slice of that digital pie, and that the share received by artists and songwriters should be increased.
Yes, and I guess there are even multiple strands just to the digital pie debate element of the wider conversation around streaming. Because I suppose if you were to agree, which you don't have to, but if you were to agree that both artists and songwriters should be getting a bigger slice of this digital pie every month, well, the way you might go about achieving that is different for artists versus songwriters. So if we take artists first, at the moment, artists do not have a direct relationship with streaming services of the Spotify variety. So they make their music available, their recordings available to Spotify through a record label or a music distributor. Spotify then pays the record label or the music distributor a chunk of money every month for the tracks that have been streamed, and then the label and distributor shares that money with the artist. So approximately, and all of these stats are always approximately of the entire digital pie every month, 50 to 55% of it will end up with labels and distributors who then have to share that money with their artists. Now, how big a share the artist gets depends entirely on the deal that the artist has done with whichever label or distributor they're working with. With some DIY distributors, they could be getting all of the money. But if they're on a record deal, they're unlikely to be getting more than 50% of the money. On a more conventional record deal, they're probably getting 20 to 25% of the money. Bearing in mind, that's of the 55% that came in, so 25% of 55%. And if you're stuck on a really old record deal, which wasn't very favourable, you could be getting much less than that. You could be getting a single figure percentage cut of the 55% or 50% cut that the record industry is getting. The key point is, every deal is different. What share an artist sees is totally dependent on the record deal. Which brings us to the whole ER thing. Because this is a way that rather than what artist receives being entirely dependent on whatever deal they did for label or distributor, there could be at least a minimum share of the money that comes in through streaming allocated to artists that would just be a set industry standard rule so that all artists would get at least X of the streaming money, and what any one record deal or distribution deal said would be irrelevant.
So yes, under current UK copyright law, when the performance and communication elements of the sound recording copyright are exploited, which would include radio, TV, and when recordings are played in public, all performers, including session musicians, have a statutory right to payment. And that means that label and distribution deals become irrelevant. All performers get paid royalties at an industry standard rate directly via the collective licensing system. ER doesn't apply on streams because it's been decided that streaming exploits the reproduction and making available elements of the copyright. And while the making available element is often seen as a subset of the communication element, UK copyright law explicitly says that ER is not due on making available. So, like all things with copyright law, it's a bit complicated. But this new letter to Boris Johnson urges the government to change the law so that ER does apply to making available and would therefore be paid out on streams.
Yeah, so during the oral hearings, as you may remember, this ER point came up on numerous occasions, and that was why you had all of those incredibly tedious, seemingly endless debates about, well, how do we define a stream? Is it a reproduction? Is it a rental? Is it a communication? Is it making available? Is it a broadcast? Is it a sale? Is it a license? And all of that was ultimately code for saying, should we pay ER on streams? And if so, how do we make that happen? And what this letter is basically saying is, we can just continue to define a stream as part reproduction, part making available, and still get ER by simply rewriting copyright law so that this ER right that does already apply to performance and communication suddenly applies to making available. So with the music industry's existing definition of streams, turns out we didn't need to have any discussions on how we define a stream. With the music industry,
which I believe you said at the time.
With the music industry's definition of streaming, if we add ER to making available, then ER would be due on streaming income.
So the letter says, today's musicians receive very little income from their streams. Most featured artists receive tiny fractions of a US cent per stream, and session musicians receive nothing at all. To remedy this, only two words need to change in the 1988 Copyright Designs and Patents Act. This will modernise the law so that today's performers receive a share of revenues just like they enjoy in radio. It won't cost the taxpayer a penny, but it will put more money in the pockets of UK taxpayers and raise revenues for public services like the NHS.
So yeah, a little bit of added politics at the end of the sentence there.
If in doubt, mention the NHS.
Mention the NHS, because if more money went into the bank accounts of artists rather than streaming services and major record companies that are ultimately incorporated elsewhere in the world, then there would be more tax available to Britain. Of course, we did mention that Gary Barlow was a signatory of this letter, but let's not bring up...
He sorted all that out now. That
was years ago.
He was mistaken.
And it was not completely fairly reported, including by us. But anyway, what they're basically saying is, let's stop trying to redefine a stream. Let's just add ER to making available in UK copyright law. Do you know what? That would just require two words to be changed in the current Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. And they're right, it would. So what this letter is basically trying to say is, we all know that the economics of streaming is very complicated. We all know the business model is complicated. We all know that there are all sorts of different elements to this debate, and there are lots of different questions that need to be answered. But hey, here's something really simple. Not only is it really simple, it's something that Parliament could do. Whereas maybe many of the other things, for example, going to a user-centric system for allocating monies to tracks each month, is something that the law can't make happen. Only the industry can make that happen. But this is something that MPs could do relatively easily by amending copyright law. It's basically what this letter is saying. And as I say, they're right. It is a simple two-word edit to the Copyright Act to introduce ER on making available. Although, as I think I've said before on Setlist, if we want to play devil's advocate here, introducing ER on making available and therefore introducing ER on streams is a simple thing to do. It's just an incredibly complicated, simple thing to do, because adding ER to streams poses a long list of questions which haven't really been answered during this whole debate in Parliament. How exactly would ER on streams work? What would it mean financially? Remember, we said a stream is both a reproduction and a making available. So does that mean if the ER is only on the making available, then it would only apply to some of the money? So at the moment with radio, with ER, it's a 50-50 split. So half the money goes to the copyright owner, usually a label, half goes to the performers. So would it be 50% of 50%? And if so, quite how would that work? Would the labels still collect the money and then pass the ER on to the Performers Collecting Society, PPL, or would PPL have to have a direct relationship with the streaming services? Who would crunch the data to work out how that money needs to be split up? How much would the administration cost? So there are lots of questions, and that's not to say that it isn't something that should happen, but I think those questions haven't been properly considered. So it's not quite as simple as just making a couple of edits to the Copyright Act. And I think, you know, if you are a featured artist, to use the old-fashioned term, a main artist, whether or not ER being added to streams would make you more money really depends on the record deal you've got or the distribution deal you've got. If you are stuck in a terrible old record deal, you will definitely be better off with an ER system. If you have signed a more recent deal, but you're still unrecouped and you're still paying off a massive cash advance you received from the label or lots of marketing costs, then with ER, you wouldn't ultimately be better off, but you would start to see money quicker. But if you're an artist that has done a much more favourable record deal, maybe with an indie, or you've set up your own label and you're working with a distributor, you could actually be worse off under ER as an artist because, well, three main reasons. Firstly, there will be a cost to administrating ER. So PPL, the Collecting Society, would be deducting some of the money as it flows through the system. We don't know what that fee would be, but I would say it's reasonable to assume it would be at least 10%. Then, of course, this money gets shared with session musicians. Now, that's why ER is incredibly attractive for session musicians, because currently they get zero, and this would get them something. And even if the something was only a pound, they would be a pound better off. But from a main artist perspective, there's an element of, well, are you happy to share the money with session musicians? Maybe you think session musicians are eternally underpaid by the music industry and they definitely deserve to get more money. Or maybe you think, actually, I paid my session musicians a fee. I thought that was the deal. Now I've got to share some of my stream money with session musicians. And then finally, you may remember at the start of this edition of Setlist, I talked about how bad copyright data screws everything up. On the song side of streaming, there's all sorts of data issues that mean lots of money gets lost to the system. And there is a risk that by bringing ER in on the recorded side, we have data issues here that means of the money diverted for ER, a load of it gets lost to the system. So there are some issues. And once you go beyond the UK, there's also concerns that having ER on streams might set a precedent that ultimately moves streaming into a compulsory statutory licensing territory, which most people agree is a bad idea. So my point is, yes, getting ER and making it available will be very simple for Parliament to do, which is what this letter says, but there are all sorts of questions that I think would need to be answered and worked out before that big, bold move was made.
Like you said, getting more money for artists and getting more money for songwriters probably requires two different solutions. And when it comes to increasing the share of streaming income received by songwriters, that would partly require a higher portion of streaming income being allocated to the song copyright rather than the recording copyright. So of the money paid by the streaming services into the music industry, currently approximately 80% goes to the recording and 20% to the song. And during the parliamentary inquiry, there was some talk about how the majors are big players in both songs and recordings. However, because of industry conventions, when money flows through the majors' labels on the recording side, they usually get to keep the majority of the money, whereas on the publishing side, the majority is handed over to the writer. Therefore, it's alleged by some, the majors have an interest in keeping the status quo and have exploited their market dominance to ensure that recordings continue to get a much bigger slice of the streaming revenues. Now, if we stop and think about that for a minute, this has moved on to competition law now. That's not a copyright law issue, and it's not clear what Parliament itself could do in that regard. So what the artists who signed this letter are calling for is for the UK competition regulator to investigate whether there is any basis for these allegations that the major labels are skewing it so that they get more money. And what the letter says on this is, there is evidence of multinational corporations wielding extraordinary power and songwriters struggling as a result. An immediate government referral to the Competition and Markets Authority is the first step to address this. We believe that in a truly free market, the song will achieve greater value.
Yes, so when it comes to getting the songwriters more money, the argument is the current situation is a result of the market dominance of the majors, so maybe that is something that the CMA should look into, which was alluded to particularly when MPs questioned ministers as part of the oral hearings in the Select Committee inquiry. As we mentioned, there was a third demand sort of thrown in at the end. Most of the letter was talking about ER to the benefit of artists and musicians, and then a competition inquiry which could potentially benefit songwriters. But it did also say at the end that the musicians who signed this letter reckon that ultimately we need a regulator to ensure the lawful and fair treatment of music makers. The UK has a proud history of protecting its producers, entrepreneurs and inventors. We believe British creators deserve the same protections as other industries whose work is devalued when exploited as a loss leader. So an interesting added request of Boris Johnson, who I am sure is already on the case with all of this. I mean, he's already told us that he's going to fix the touring issues created by his stupid Brexit.
Yep.
He's already on the case of that. I mean, he said that a few weeks ago. I'm sure that's already addressed behind the scenes. Of course, there's the whole issue that every festival that could happen this year once COVID restrictions are lifted in June isn't going to happen because of insurance issues that Boris Johnson has done nothing about. But you never know. Maybe behind the scenes he's fixing that. So next week he can get going with what is said in this letter. It's interesting. I mean, we mentioned 156 artists and musicians and songwriters signed this letter, put the names of this letter. So you mentioned Paul McCartney, Damon Albarn, Gary Barlow. There was also Fiona Bevan, Billy Bragg, Kate Nash, Badly Drawn Boy, Brian Eno, Paloma Faith, Shy FX, Gabrielle, and Chris Martin, and Laura Mavula, and Kate Nash, and lots of other people as well, which I suppose it ensured that this letter got an awful lot of press. And I mean, the inquiry in Parliament actually has been getting quite a lot of coverage beyond the music industry trade press. But this letter in particular, I mean, all the broadsheets reported on it, the broadcast media reported on it, and actually got quite a bit of pickup in the US as well. I think, you know, some of the bigger name artists on this list, particularly Paul McCartney, helped swing some coverage in the US. So that was interesting. Although I have to say, it was also a bit depressing. Shall I explain why it was a bit depressing?
Yeah, because I thought we were going to end this on a positive note. So, yeah, you tell us how it's depressing now.
Yeah, it's not depressing because of the content of the letter. It's not depressing because of what the letter is asking for.
Is it the font? Because not everyone cares about fonts as much as you do.
The font was fine. The font was a nice, basic, serviceable font. It's not even that I suspect the Culture Select Committee in Parliament will embrace a lot of what has been asked for in this letter, and then the UK government will do a very good job of ignoring everything that the Select Committee recommends. I mean, obviously, that's why this letter was not addressed to the committee. It was addressed directly to government. But it was interesting, because all the mainstream news media were reporting on this letter in the US and the UK, and I read a bunch of those reports because they were popping up in our news feed for our news monitoring operations, but also in my social feed. So I had a quick look at some of them. And it is complicated, I know. And not everybody is obsessed about music business models and copyright and licensing like I am. And obviously nobody has been researching it like CMU and MMF has for a number of years now. But I would say I think I read about 20 articles covering this letter, and not one of them got everything right. Every article had a sentence that wasn't quite right. Some had sentences which were like, yeah, that's kind of a misrepresentation of how it works, or that's you know, a bit misleading. And then some just had statements that were outright wrong. There was one article in The Telegraph, I think, where there was a relatively short paragraph about a third of the way down that had four errors in it. And the reason why this is depressing is just for me personally, because when you read articles about something that you know a lot about, maybe you would even call yourself an expert on the topic.
Mm.
And you read the articles and you're like, yeah, that's not quite right. And that's a bit misleading. And it's like, yeah, that's just wrong. On other days, I read these newspapers, these news websites, and these journalists when they're writing about stuff about which I don't know anything. And I read the articles and I assume that what they've said is right. And I leave those articles thinking, oh, I've educated myself. I'm informed on that issue now. And what you realise is, presumably, every time one of those articles get published, there's an expert somewhere else in the world reading them going, well, that's not quite right, and that's a bit misleading, and that's just outright wrong. And so it just... That's why it's depressing, because it makes you question everything you've ever read in any newspaper ever.
So what you're saying is don't read.
I think that could be the conclusion of this. Unless Boris Johnson is listening, which I'm sure he is.
I know he's a fan.
In which case, do read the letter. Before you give up reading, actually, I think in Boris Johnson's case, it might be not needing to give up reading. It may be that he needs to take up reading for the purposes of this letter. And then once you've read this letter, then you can give up reading like normal. So yeah, there you go. A letter was written. We'll see what happens.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
And finally this week, over in everyone's favourite union, the European Union, there were calls for the European Union to beef up an element of its proposed Digital Services Act that would obligate internet companies to do more to confirm the identity of their business customers. So currently, the Digital Services Act only proposes introducing new obligations in that domain to online marketplaces. But the copyright industries reckon it should also apply to other internet intermediaries who might be providing domain names, server space, or advertising or payment services to business customers who could, possibly, be operating websites that infringe copyright.
Yes, so the Digital Services Act is some legislative...
It's hard, isn't it? Legislative. Is that it?
Legislative. I can't say it. Legal reforms being considered in the European Union alongside another set of proposals called the Digital Markets Act. And this is basically looking at the responsibilities of online platforms and also a little bit at the market dominance of certain online platforms and whether laws across the European Union should be changed to increase the obligation of internet companies so to protect their users. So this is basically the EU version of the proposals that have been made here in the UK. In the UK, they fall under the banner of the online harms legislation. So that's basically what the Digital Services Act, Digital Markets Act is trying to do. There's a little bit of competition law thrown in there as well. So these are proposals that are currently working their way through the lawmaking process within the European Union, being debated in the European Parliament and the EU Council. Now, these are not specifically copyright or intellectual property proposals, because obviously we've already had a copyright directive in Europe, which was looking at the obligations of platforms when it comes to IP. So this is more about things like abusive content and offensive content and misleading content. And then a little bit about the big tech giants who control whole ecosystems and how other people and other companies can access audiences through those platforms. That's what this is all about. That said, copyright owners, copyright industries, like the music business, are hopeful that there might be a few reforms that they could get into these proposals as they go through the process that would potentially benefit the copyright and intellectual property industries. And this is one of them. So this isn't specifically changing copyright law. It would actually be changing internet law, but in a way that might help copyright owners. In particular, a way that might help copyright owners sue pirates is really what this is about. Because as we know, one of the challenges if you are a copyright owner in the digital age is when people are infringing your content online, distributing your content online, allowing other people to share or stream or rip or copy or download content that's protected by copyright without the copyright owner's permission. So copyright infringement is occurring. One of the challenges for copyright owners is the law says, well, if people are infringing your copyrights, go sue them. But online, it can be hard to work out who the hell is behind the infringement, who is running a website. And I mean, the Pirate Bay is the perfect example here, isn't it? We know that the Pirate Bay has been successfully sued numerous times in numerous countries, but the only lawsuit that had any impact was the time that the original founders of the Pirate Bay were both prosecuted and sued in the Swedish courts. Because in the early days of the Pirate Bay, we knew who was running it. Because the people who set up the Pirate Bay were very upfront about the fact that they were running it, and they were constantly putting out statements. So they could be both prosecuted and sued, and they were. But having learnt what happens when you admit to the world that you run an incredibly famous and popular piracy site, all the people involved in running that site since the founders have done so anonymously. So even though lots of music companies and lots of other copyright owners have successfully sued the Pirate Bay over the years, they don't actually know who they're suing, because we don't know who runs the Pirate Bay anymore. So what this letter is asking for is, actually, under current European law, if you are a business that has operations online, you are actually obliged to tell the world who you are and where you're based and what your address is and what your phone number is and a contact email address. That needs to be on the website under European law. But needless to say, people who've set up websites to infringe copyright generally don't publish their name and address and phone number on their website. And so what the copyright industries are asking for here is that there should be a new platform responsibility, which is that if you're providing services to somebody else's website, so you're hosting it, or you are managing their domain name, or you're providing them with advertising services or payment services, you should have a obligation to verify the identity of that customer, so you know exactly who they are and where they live. And you should probably also be checking that they're making that information available in a public way, as they are obliged to do under European law. So that's what the copyright industries want. They basically want a new obligation for internet platforms to know your business customer. And as you said, the current draft of the DSA, the Digital Services Act, does add that obligation to online marketplaces. So that would be like eBay or the Amazon marketplace, or it would cover secondary ticketing websites as well. But it doesn't apply it to server hosting companies or to domain registries or to ad networks and payment providers. And so that is basically what this consortium of trade bodies representing all different kinds of copyright, that is what they're asking for, that this element of the Digital Services Act that adds this new know your business obligation to marketplaces also adds it to anybody else selling internet services to a website that might be infringing copyright and might be breaking the European law that says they need to declare who they are in public.
Yeah, so this open letter, which is signed by various organisations, including music industry groups like the IFPI, Impala and the BPI, says that in a responsible and mature economy, businesses should not be able to operate and have access to the modern necessary infrastructure Europe has to offer without accurately identifying themselves. This applies equally to the offline and to the online world, which is why in 2000, legislation introduced an obligation on businesses to identify themselves on websites. Unfortunately, and unsurprisingly, businesses that have the intention of making a profit out of illegal content do not comply with this obligation and do not suffer consequences. It then criticised only applying new obligations to online marketplaces, saying such a limited approach is a missed opportunity to address the broad range of illegal content and counterfeit, unsafe, non-compliant and substandard products online. The DSA presents a real opportunity to rectify a situation that allows bad actors to ignore the obligations under that 2000 legislation with impunity. A business cannot go online without a domain name, without being hosted, or without advertisement or payment services, the letter goes on. These intermediary services, having a direct relationship with the business, are therefore best placed to make sure that only businesses that are willing to comply with the law have access to their services.
So it'll be interesting to see how the European Parliament and the EU Council responds to these demands to force all internet intermediaries to verify their business customers and to check that they are complying with that rule about being transparent about who they are. But either way, it was interesting to see another way in which the copyright industries, like the music industry, are hoping that maybe these debates around platform responsibility in the EU could help the copyright industries, even though that is not the primary objective of what all this reform is about.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do subscribe if this is your first time listening, or you've just for some reason never subscribed before, and then you'll just get all the new episodes automatically and your life will be improved, I guarantee. You can also rate us wherever that's possible, review us wherever that's possible, and if you've got anything you need to say to us directly, then email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.